The following is an interview of Russell Hostler, Professor Emeritus of Business Education of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, conducted on January 23, 1979, by Mark Van Pelt. Well, perhaps you could start out by talking a little bit about your family background or about the any special influences that steered you towards your ultimate career.
Well, first I guess perhaps we should record my name is Russell Hostler, and I came from Northwestern Ohio. My family operated a small town general store, and I went to the high school in that small town of Oakwood, 500 people. I graduated from high school in 1925, and I think they 14 in my class. And summer 1925, after graduating in the spring, I was working in the store, general store, when a representative from Bliss College in Columbus, a private business school, came by to solicit my attendance to Bliss College. In those days, all over the United States, and particularly in Ohio, the normal schools for preparation of business or commercial teachers, as they were known then, were primarily in the private business schools, because after all, business education had its origin in the private business schools shortly after the Civil War, mid-1850s. And so as business education went into the high school, it was rather natural that the curriculum from the private business schools and the teaching from the private business schools would follow. So at that time, if one wanted to be a commercial teacher in Ohio, the only place you'd get that kind of preparation was a private business college. Now, may I say, I had no idea that until this gentleman came along that I ever wanted to be a business teacher. As a matter of fact, I had no idea I wanted to be a teacher of any kind. If when I graduated from high school I had anything in mind, was that I didn't want to be a teacher. I had some idea of going to Northern College at Ada, Ohio, nearby, and I was going to go on some general, but I had really no guidance and counseling, and I had just a vague idea what I would do if nothing, if anything.
What did your parents do in terms of, did they help you towards a career? Were they looking for something for you?
No, or? They, in those days, in that environment, very few people went to college, and my parents had neither one gone to even high school, and I had the general vague idea that I wanted to go to college, but until this man came along, certainly not business, because our small high school had no business courses whatsoever. I didn't even know what a typewriter was, hardly. I know that the across the street there was a man operating an insurance office that had a double keyboard, that is a lower case down here and the upper case up there, two different keyboards, and that was the only typewriter I had ever seen. In 1925 I hadn't been out to the large cities and in other environments, and so he sold me on the idea. He said, you can come to Bliss College, and they had a state-approved normal program for the preparation of commercial teachers along with their other.
So he originally tried to get you to come to prepare for teaching rather than to come and get a business education.
Right. Well, business teacher education, that was what he was selling. I thought perhaps he thought I might be interested. If first place it was a two-year program, many of the other programs only 1 year, and of course he was out for his subscription fee. And but nevertheless, he sold me on the idea. He said, you can come here and become a teacher 2 years, whereas if you want to be an English teacher or a math teacher, you'd have to go 4 years. Well, I was very naive, but it did sound like He made it sound very attractive. And the brochures of the private business schools were always developed to be very attractive looking. And I think the private business schools traditionally over the years have drawn heavily from the small towns where people haven't had too many experiences outside of their community. So I went to Bliss College in 1925, and in a two-year program there, I started from scratch and everything. I had nothing. Typing, shorthand, accounting, law, all those subjects were, and I had my teacher preparation. I had a semester of student teaching in Central High School in Columbus, Ohio. And this was approved by the state, but it was a very poor program. I went over there to the second semester of my second year. I was taken out to Central High School in Columbus, big city high school, and I was to do my student teaching in typewriting. I don't know who determined that, but that's where I was headed. So I went, the principal took me down to the teacher, and introduced me to the teacher, and she had a class of 35 students. And so I observed the rest of that period. The end of the period, she says, "Oh, I'm so glad that you're here. I'm so overcrowded. I just need help and relief, and the class is yours." I didn't see her again for several weeks. I had absolutely no supervision, so it was sink or swim, and I don't know how I
Bliss College didn't check in on you.
No, there's no supervision. Only there may have been a call or two, but they had no one. And
what did you, at the time, as you refer to their program as poor, but at the time, what did you think of it? Do you remember that? What was your action once you got there?
Yeah, sure. Your values in this world are in relation to your experiences and background. And so up to that point, as I look back now, I can see it was very, very minimal. But I had no other criteria to use in evaluating other than just the current experience. So I finished in 2 years and got a certificate to teach, and was interviewed to teach at Montpelier, Ohio, which was right up northwestern, only a few miles from, 30 miles or so from my home. And I started teaching there fall of 1927. And with 2 years of preparation, and I guess I was the only teacher in the system that didn't have a bachelor's degree. But I was too naive to let it bother me any, and didn't realize I should have realized I was a second-class citizen, but no one really treated me that way. But so I taught there for 7 years and was married the first year, and had a child within a year. But I also realized that I needed some academic training, and that Defiance College was a small liberal arts college about 15, 20 miles from Montpelier. And matter of fact, it was between my hometown of Oakwood and Montpelier, so it was easy to get to. So I went there and registered. And over, part-time, going to Saturday classes and Thursday and summer sessions, by 1932, I had done the equivalent of 3 years. They accepted just a minimal amount of work from Bliss College, but I was able to finish in an equivalent of 3 years of undergraduate work, and then I got a BA degree in economics and major in history, unrelated to business. They didn't have business courses at this school. And my primary objective was to get a bachelor's degree, which I eventually did, but all full-time. So, well, I don't know, I could just quickly, I did move from there to Fostoria in 1934, and I went to Fostoria because the man who was then the superintendent had been a teacher and principal of this little high school I attended when I was in school, and I guess he must have had some favorable impression of me while I was in high school, and he had a sudden vacancy developed where one of his business teachers got a better job elsewhere. So I was invited to come there and was at Fostoria, a much larger school, and for 4 years. And then in 1937, 38, I had a chance to go to Libby High School. At that time, I had no graduate work with a family responsibility, maximum salary of something like $1,700 a year. you obviously couldn't accumulate very much. In those days, there were no scholarships or any financial aid for students, so I had to hack it off myself. And so I got the job then at Libby High School, teaching there in 1938, and went to Toledo University there at night because I was then in town, got my master's degree in economics and business, and some in very little in education. So I really got my start at Bliss College, and what I learned most about business education, I self-taught, because my formal education then on was pretty much general education. Until I then, just circumstances in 1942, the war broke out, of course, and Indiana University said I had a naval training school program, and they were looking desperately all over the country for individuals to come, business teachers to come who were not in the service and teach in this naval training school. It was a storekeeper's, well, originally as a yeoman, but it was all dealing with office work. And Dr. Eister, who was the director of this program, and I knew each other from a couple of professional contacts, so he invited me to come, which I guess I got the invitation about 2 weeks before I was to be there, so I quickly made arrangements for my family to stay on and resign. I had to resign. They wouldn't give me a leave of absence at Toledo for that. So I really burned my bridge and went to Indiana for this naval training school. Eventually the family followed me, of course. And then after 2 years, that program closed. In the meantime, I had become the assistant to the director in the program, and I was invited to stay on. There were, I suppose we had 125 or more faculty members who came in and taught during that two-year period for a part of it. Some would come and be drafted, a lot of turnover. But we had a great influx. We had the first WAIS, when the WAIS were first organized as a contingent of the Navy, they actually came to Indiana before they had been to any boot training. So for initially they had their boot training, and at that time I was teaching naval organization, so I had become an expert on the organization of the Navy out of the books. I had no practical experience, of course. But after 2 years, the school had fulfilled its objective, and then I was asked to stay on. And meantime, I had started working on my doctorate with Eister, and so the only way, I had no financial background. I couldn't have gone the traditional way of going to school, you know. I had to do it. All the time since I started in 1927 up until I retired, I never missed being on full-time, excepting one semester, which I'll mention in just a moment. So I stayed on because it gave me a wonderful opportunity. I taught then with Eister in the School of Business and in the area of business. During that period, I was working hard on my doctorate. And in the fall of November of 1945, and this was my second year after the Naval Training School had closed, there was a call from Wisconsin to Eister saying, we are now exploring establishing a program in business education at the University of Wisconsin. This call came from Dean Anderson, the then Dean of the School of Education, and Dean Elwell, who is the Dean of the School of Business. Dean Anderson retired just a year or two after I came in 1946, and Elwell retired in the early 1950s, but he's still living, by the way. Fay Elwell is in his 90s, and Anderson has been dead for many years. But those two men, Elwell in business and Anderson in education, presumably with the support of their faculty, had made the decision, and there had been a great deal of outside pressure to establish a graduate program here, because there was no other school There were no schools even, well, business teachers, if they wanted to do graduate work, they'd have to go to Iowa had a program at the time, and Northwestern had, and Columbia, New York University, Pittsburgh, but you could almost count them on the fingers of your two hands in the country, the number of graduate programs. So when I came in 46, it was a very virgin territory. I came here in November. I should back up just a moment, and was interviewed, and they offered me the position, but with the stipulation that I'd have my to start then the following June, the summer session of 46, with the understanding I'd have my doctorate completed. Well, I had finished all requirements, was working, starting to work on my dissertation. So when I went back in November with the offer, I knew that I had to finish that. So the only semester, the only time I ever took off from full-time teaching was that second semester, and I made arrangements then to take a leave and drew out my savings and my Ohio teacher retirement. That was the only way, the only reserve I had, you know. Mm-hmm. Things were not very good financially in those days. So I finished then in June, by working very hard during that semester, and came here in June, and that was the start. Now, why did I come to Wisconsin? Well, it was the opportunity. There was, and I have said many, many times, there absolutely could not have been a better situation developed for me professionally than that which did here, because there had been no program, and I had enough experience working with Eicher and others, and a good sense of programs and directions, and by that time I had developed some national contacts. So I originally Wisconsin because I had the opportunity, but afterwards I had early had several opportunities to move to other schools, and I turned down all opportunities, even going back to Ohio State as a full professor when I was still only an assistant professor here, because I just knew the opportunities here would be so much greater than anywhere, and they have been, they were, and so that's pretty much the answer to that, I guess.
When you were still teaching high school before the war came, did you have any firm intention to go on for a doctorate and take up college teaching?
Absolutely none, because that was beyond any possibility. My financial means, without the war, I could not be sitting here with you today, because there would have been no way, absolutely no way, that I could have pursued a doctorate or had any hopes of doing this. No, I suppose I might have been dreaming at times, but no realistic idea or objectives. And it wasn't until I went to Indiana and I sure had started this graduate program, and many of the people who came there also then became interested in graduate work, and it was through Eicher's guidance and the program being available that I got interested, and I saw that others had finished, and I began thinking, well, maybe this is something I could do. Until that point, I really didn't comprehend the possibility that this would be something I could handle or do.
Now, I know that there are a number of people who went into graduate work in the 30s and 40s who are in your position, that is, not the youngest students in the world.
Right.
And I know that, in some cases anyway, that has been occasion for people not to be allowed to go on to advanced work simply because of their age factor and that sort of thing. That has been discouraged. I know that they did that here in the 30s from time to time. They kind of discouraged people because of age reasons, anything else. Did you ever find that a problem?
No, because at that time, most of my peers were people who were quite, you know, it was unheard of, really, in my experience, for people to go to a university and get an undergraduate degree and then go into graduate work, maybe with a minimum of a year or two experience, and then right on toward the doctorate, because there just weren't people in our field. And for that matter, I don't think there were many in all of education. And so I was 40 when I came here. I was 40 when I finished the degree, and Of course, as I look back now, 40 is a pretty young person. But all the years I served as advising graduate students here, I never would prohibit, if I had the power to prohibit, a person doing graduate work at any age. Mm-hmm. But I would counsel them the problems. Now, there have been many people, well, several, I'm sure, over the years that I've been in Wisconsin that have expressed interest in graduate work, and in my judgment, it would be ill-advised with their family responsibilities and all, and the difficulties. So I do my best to inform them and discourage where it seems desirable. But I don't know if they, I suppose if a person who enjoys in the academic world and experience, why not let them pursue it? Of course, some would say this might be a waste of facilities and resources, but even at an older age. But in general, it is true at an earlier period, well, I would say up until about the last 10, 15, 20 years, we have began to have people like yourself pursuing graduate work, not too far removed from their undergraduate work, you mm-hmm. see.
When you said you were interviewed here, who interviewed you? You had a joint appointment with Business and Education. Were you interviewed by the business people as well?
Yes, that was interesting. I came here and appointment was set up. Ira Davis was then the chairman of... Now, Ira Davis is a science education man, well-known, written extensively at his office that was at Wisconsin High, and he was chairman of the department called Educational Methods. I don't know where you have this in any of your... But the Educational Methods Department was constituted by the people who were teaching methods and supervising student teaching in the various areas, and Ira was chairman of the department called Educational Methods at Wisconsin High at that time. Milt Powell is his successor, and Milt, by the way, finished his graduate work with Ira. But Ira, the official letter of invitation then came from Ira Davis, even though the dean had initiated. Back in those days, the deans had a lot more freedom of operation than they have today. The search and screen committee operation, there was no such in those days for maybe any position, but certainly not in this one. So I got the letter from Ira Davis inviting me to come here on a Sunday, arrive Sunday night and be available Monday, and I guess maybe to Tuesday. And so I arrived at the Lorraine Hotel at 10 o'clock on a Sunday night, coming from Indiana. And I remember I'd been in Indiana before that, Ohio, where everything in the way of bars and liquor being served were closed on Sunday. And I still remember my surprise walking into the Lorraine Hotel at 10 o'clock at night and seeing this bar over here, people being served liquor. Still just a boy from the country. And... So the next morning, Glenn I, who was then principal of Wisconsin High School, picked me up, that was prearranged, and took me out to Wisconsin High School, and I spent the morning there, and then visiting with, Ira Davis and other people, and it was understood that this position would be joint among school business, school of education, and Wisconsin High School. Of course, Wisconsin High School, I should say, school of education, meaning the Department of Education. Well, we visited, and then they took me to Dean Anderson over in the school of education, the old building. And Dean Anderson and I visited, first opportunity I had to meet him, although he was the one that had made the initial call to Eyster in Indiana. And so we were visiting, and I said, well, we better get over to the university club for luncheon. Now, no one had mentioned any luncheon to me. I had no knowledge. But we went over there in due time. We met in one of the private rooms, and a man that sat next to me, now I can't think of his name, he's the president of the university at that time, Oh, in agriculture, still living. I'm sorry, my mind is blank on it. But he had only recently become president, but to answer your question, at that meeting, there was a dean of school of business I met for the first time, Elwell, Dean Anderson, the president of the university, maybe we can think of a due time. But then there were faculty members from both School of Business and School of Education. And so we had, I guess I would have been greatly concerned if I had known this in advance, but I had no opportunity to prepare anything. And after we got through eating, I guess Dean Elwell came up and said, well, now the purpose of this meeting is to look at Mr. Hosler and give him an opportunity to look at us, and so we'll ask questions. So we spent several minutes there. They asked questions, and I reacted. Because, you see, this is proposing now a brand new program, the University of Wisconsin. And so apparently I satisfied them sufficiently, because before I left, I was assured the offer would come. I know there must have been some whispering. You see, again, those things did function less formally than they do today. They weren't other people interviewed. I guess they had been some others considered, possibly.
When they asked you questions, were they primarily concerned with what you would do to set up this program, or
right,
were they more concerned with your own academic training?
Well, yes, primarily, I think, with respect to the place of business education in the academic world and the need for, as I would see it, for a graduate program and a program in business education. And you see, the teachers in the state of Wisconsin had appealed many times to the dean of the School of Education, Anderson, and to Dean Elwell, and to other faculty people, that here we ought to, in this state, have some place we can go and do graduate work. They could come to Wisconsin if they wish, but they couldn't get anything in their academic area. They could get something else, but obviously. And most of the people who came were from Whitewater. At that time, Whitewater was the only undergraduate school in the state. And so when I started here, a very large percentage of my graduate students were graduates of Whitewater. And just to complete the story, I was given the invitation to come with the understanding, I think my salary was to be, $3,800, and that was the largest salary I'd ever had in my life, because I taught for 15 years in high school in Ohio and never earned more than $2,000 in academic year. Of course, that's all during the Depression years.
What was your first impression of Wisconsin and of the people you were supposed to deal with?
Very favorable. I just thought I was the luckiest person in the world to have this opportunity. I just was very much impressed. I had been at Indiana for 4 years, so I had learned something of university life. Prior to that, my background was zero. But with the 4 years at Indiana, and I got to know a good many of the professors, and so I had that means to, you know, to make an evaluation. Now, I was very much impressed.
When you first came here, stepping ahead a second, which faculty did you find yourself, you know, as any person starting out in a new job, which people did you find were most helpful to you or influential in helping shape your beginning?
Well, as a matter of fact, my program that I guess I'm more oriented. My professional home, I think, from the very beginning was in School of Education, the faculty of the School of Education, because I was in the business of preparing business teachers. And the degree, by the way, is very interesting. The degree that was in the graduate school was the master's degree now, Master of Science in Business Education. And this was a special degree that had been established. Really, it had been established because there was a stigma attached to my field. I recognize it. So they didn't want to taint any other program by putting these graduate students in, let's say, the degree in the School of Business, a BBA, or the Master's, MBA, Master of Business, Master of Business Administration, or in the general degree in education.
Who is they?
Well, the faculty. The faculty.
Were they all pretty straightforward about that, or?
Well, no, this had been established before I got here. As a matter of fact, the degree had been established, this is 46, and the degree had been established in 44, but no one here had yet been employed to implement it. And I think maybe at that time the two deans were instrumental, and they could be more instrumental in those days to do that kind of thing. But so I came, and I was in charge of this program. So as far as the graduate school is concerned, I was chairman of a department, and all applications came directly to me. I did not work through any other department, so it was a beautiful, I loved it because it gave me complete freedom to make recommendations with respect to admission directly to the graduate school. My contact were directly with the graduate school, and that continued until just a few years before my retirement.
Did you ever get the feeling that some of the faculty in other departments, as it were, weren't always happy with that kind of arrangement, or
wanted? No, I don't think so. I just didn't. I didn't make a noise about it to the fact that I would irritate other people. I've learned my life.
Sometimes you don't have to do that, though.
Yeah.
Sometimes you don't have to.
Well,
make any
no,
noise
but
about
I don't think anyone. I wasn't always announcing the fact. I think many people may not even realize it, accepting the administrators and so forth.
Backtracking just a second. You mentioned that you were taken by surprise, so to speak, about this luncheon. And I'm quite sure now that standard procedure is to have each candidate give a formal presentation to the faculty, sort of, well, usually before they have any real lengthy discussions, but yours seem to be rather informal all around.
Right, right.
That's correct.
Yeah, right, right.
And the other question I have is, you didn't seem to have any contact with the School of Business faculty people much outside of this luncheon. Is that correct?
Well,
before you were hired.
Yeah, Bob, but not a great deal different than education. I did. Seems to be that afternoon or the next morning, meet with the three or four over there and visit with them. And I don't recall visiting with more than three or four in education. Primarily, I met Ira Davis and Glenn I. And I don't know, maybe Arvo Barr. But of course, numbers were so small in those days compared to now. Yeah, you know, just pursuing this point of how to handle people who are being interviewed for position candidates, I've always had to take the position that it's so much better for a small group to interview the person, to have a formal presentation as developed in recent years, as you say. But I was always one to feel that there is great benefit in having the person give a presentation, informal or whatever, to a larger group, so that the idiotic program that procedures we use for so often would be to have a candidate come and go to your office for 30 minutes, another office for 30 minutes, and he's repeating himself over and over. After a while, his story gets pretty dull to him. But whereas if he can give out to a large group, I think you get a better appraisal of the person. So, and I think that has resulted, and then of course it's more economical time by great odds. Now, I don't know, would you want me to pursue now people such as the Department of Education, and when I became chairman of that, or is that?
Well, I had one more question that might get us off on that line.
Okay.
I have a sense, just from looking at the materials that I found, that your contact with the faculty of the School of Business and your general interaction with the School of Business has not been great exactly. That is, that you, although part of the School of Business, or at least appointed as part of the School of Business, you've been sort of by yourself, as you mentioned. Even though, if I remember correctly, even when you were chairman of the department, you were funded in greater part by the School of Business than by the School of Education. Can you comment on that?
Yeah. My relationships have always been good with business. They've always been supportive. I think maybe I should back up at this point and tell how we got an undergraduate program going. When I came here, there was no undergraduate program at all. Now, there was a program whereby people in the School of Business could come to education and take the 18 credits, and somebody, I think, over in business taught a methods class in bookkeeping and become certified to teach bookkeeping. But this was an incomplete program. And so when I, a year after I got here, I began to, and it was understood when I was invited that I should explore developing an undergraduate program. Now, the graduate program was there. They had the degree set up. There was only one course, so that year before I arrived, through correspondence, I proposed the two courses that I had for many, many years, and they were approved before I got here. So the summer of 1946, I had a program of two courses dealing professional courses now in the field of business ed. And I had something like 28 students that seen the announcement in the catalogs and were there. Many of them as special students, but they're all business teachers. Well, so that was the start of this graduate program, but we had no undergraduate program. Wisconsin High School, by the way, had no courses in typewriting. It had been in existence for many, many years, since 1914, and this was 1946, and those kids had no opportunity to take typewriting. So I was asked to set up a course in typewriting at Wisconsin High School, which I did that first year. Well, then I talked to Dean Fowkes, replaced Dean John Anderson as Dean of School of Education, about setting up a program in preparation of business teachers, a complete program, which would mean put in courses in the secretarial area, because this is where 60 to 75% of the teacher's time in the high school in the office ed phase, and that those courses were zero here. I came in 46. I would guess in 47, early in Dean Fowkes' career, the 47-48 school year, he asked the School of Education for authorization to appoint a committee to make recommendations on a undergraduate program in business teacher education. It was given, and he appointed me as chairman, and then he appointed Dean Gomnitz from the School of Business, Dean Willing from the School of Education. Now I'm going to have trouble. But Triwata, who was chairman of the Geography Department, the then chairman of the Math Department, I can't recall his name, and I should have thought of this event. And another, and there were two people from history. So it was loaded pretty heavily with people from the academic field and people who had great stature on this campus. And I said to Dean Fowkes, Dean Fowkes, I said, in point of this committee, I said, you got loaded against me. There's no way I'm going to convince this group. And he said, well, if you can't convince that group, you don't have any chance of getting it through the general faculty. So we met a couple times, and I had done my homework, had a good deal of background information as to the needs for this kind of program, and finally they agreed. They agreed that the new courses totaling 18 credits, which would be in the School of Business as business credits, but restricted to people preparing to teach. And so the committee, and gave me great pleasure and joy, approved it. Initially, it was approved all but one, and the chairman of the math department had reservations with respect to the number of credits. He felt 18 college university credits for an area of shorthand and typewriting and related subject was just too many. So I said, I went into Dean Fawcett, I said, the committee has approved it unanimously for the program, but and I'm sorry, I didn't do my homework on this. The chairman of the math department had vetoed the number of credits. And John Guy Fox said, well, Russ, you better go back and get him. Unless it's a unanimous program, you're going to have difficulty. So I went back and had a conversation with him. And before the meeting was over, he says, okay, you've convinced me, I'll go along with the committee. So from that, when it went to the faculty, it was just automatic approval, I guess, with it, those people being instrumental. So that program was approved and set up and began. Our first graduates were in the spring of 1950, a two-year program. Mm-hmm. And so this had to be maybe in the spring of 48, and we got started in the fall of 48, 49, 49, 50. Mm-hmm. And but that was quite an achievement. And now there was great cooperation from the School of Business. Now we had to set up a laboratory equipment, and that was taken from the budgets of the School of Business, School of Education. Both colleges supported the capital outlay of the equipment needed. I don't know, in those days it was something like $15,000-$20,000, but that was a lot of money in those days.
Where was it set up?
It was in the meantime. By the way, I should mention, the first 4 years I was here, I had the only office I had was at Wisconsin High, a little cubbyhole over there that was shared with Laura Johnson, who was a professor in language education. And this program, so I was there 1 year, and we were in a Quonset hut the first year they got started, 48, 49. But the summer of 1950, the School of Education building was vacated entirely by the engineers. They moved to the new campus, at that time. And so the School of Education became available entirely for School of Education people. Until that time, it had been known as EE, Education and Engineering. So I was giving a space, very good space, up on the fourth floor, looking out over the lake. It was a beautiful area. It wasn't, the painting and decorating was very poor. But nevertheless, that's where we got our start then, the fall of 1950 up there.
So that's where you had the equipment for that?
Yes, of course, it actually had been set up for a year, operated in a Quonset hut over in the Wisconsin High area. There's some Quonset buildings.
Okay.
Are those 30-minute tapes?
45 on this.
45.
Now, the people who taught these courses for these 18 credits, were they primarily out of School of Business then, or?
Well, no, they were.
You taught them?
I taught some, yes, and we had employed a full-time person as an instructor, person without a doctorate, but some initially, a lady from Indiana came and was employed to teach, and then things didn't work out too well. She was also teaching one class at Wisconsin High School. One year we had a man that we got from a junior college in Illinois, from the name of Latimer, and he was here for 2 years, but he saw that the opportunities, he didn't have a doctorate, and he saw the opportunities would be limited for him if he were to remain. So he decided to go back to a junior college teaching where he had been originally. And then from that time on, there were people, primarily doctorate students who were experienced teachers of shorthand mm-hmm. and typewriting who taught with me. One was Robert Kessel, Bob Kessel, I think maybe followed there in the 50s, and had taught in high school and had gotten his master's and was now pursuing. He, by the way, is at the University of Idaho, and has been out there for many years, and chairman of their department in business teacher education. But Bob Kessel, then, while he was pursuing his graduate work, taught as an assistant one time, and then also as a part-time instructor. And then after he finished his degree, he stayed on full-time for a while until the opportunity came up at Idaho.
So did he then work under you?
Yes, right. I was responsible. In other words, these courses in the School of Business in the secretarial area were my responsibility, and I employed people to work with me in teaching them.
Now, going back a second, I'm kind of fascinated about these committees because, I mean, there are different ways that committees can work, I suppose, and the university often employs a committee of the sort that you mentioned to decide issues, but I always had the impression there's a cooperative effort, but you seem to be saying that the people were put on this committee with you, but you were assigned the task more or less of convincing them that it was okay, and if you could convince them, then that's how it worked.
Well, this committee on the undergraduate
right.
program, yeah, that I think that was true because they had no background whatsoever in this field of business education, and so I think you've said it well. This committee was organized primarily with the idea that they represented various segments of the campus, and there were people with prestige and status, and if I could convince these people this program had merit, then it would be accepted elsewhere.
Did any of them ever ask you in your discussions, or did they ever think that perhaps this kind of program was better off, you know, or why didn't we just rely on business schools or, you know, the two-year type schools to
right,
do this sort of
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, right.
Why did they ever...
Oh, yes, that question came up, and I could talk at length on that, but sure, this has come up many, many times, and if you're going to prepare math teachers, if you're going to, after all, math is what they're going to be teaching out there, and if you have other people teach your students the math that they're going to need, you have no control of the subject matter area. You're dependent mm-hmm. on the other people, and since the subject matter contained in the sequence of 18 credits was fundamental for a person to be a successful teacher. And I just felt we had to have a handle of this and control of it, and I still feel very strongly. Now, we've always had a procedure, and we set it up originally for exemption from the elementary courses, and I think that makes sense. A person who's had previous work, of course, that's done throughout the campus.
Sure.
If you've had French in high school, you start at a higher level than you do if you haven't had.
Right.
And so with respect to slotting people into the proper place in the program was pretty much like languages. They were exempted, often with an examination, sometimes merely an examination of their records, what they'd done.
When you were first appointed here, were you expected to come to faculty meetings of the School of Business and that sort of thing and to participate in shaping program material that they had?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I always did. I was a member of the faculty. I participated. As a matter of fact, I was on the graduate for a long time. I was on the graduate programs committee in the School of Business, and also on the graduate program committee, the Department of Education, and later CNI. One reason for this, if we might get into this, was the fact that I was on the administrative committee of the graduate school for about a 7-year period, and I.
When was that?
Well, I'd have to look up the dates, but it probably in the
1962?
quit.
Administration
well,
committee?
No, it was later than that.
To 69?
59 to maybe 65, 6, long in there. This all ties up to the cooperative graduate program that was established with the colleges. If you well, let me go back to this other. Because I had this experience with the administrative committee of the graduate school, I was able to be a benefit and help to the School of Business graduate school because I was sort of a liaison. I was familiar with the business going on in the School of Business, and I mean the graduate school, and so I was accepted. I was a part of that faculty, but obviously my voice in determining the program in other areas of School of Business would be minimal because that isn't my background.
Mm-hmm.
Like someone once said, when you don't know what others are talking about, clam up and listen, and that's what I would do, you see, until I got sufficient background.
Mm-hmm. When you took your PhD in Indiana, was most of your coursework then in education, or did they also ask you to do a lot of coursework in economics? And
well,
business?
Right, it was really a joint program. I had a goodly number of courses in School of Business, but I would not have the depth preparation in School of Business courses that the person who majors solely, in School of Business. And because I did have professional courses in education, so it was a joint program there, as it has always been here. But you get enough of a background to have some savvy, some knowledge, obviously. But you wouldn't want to feel that you could converse with those who had, let's say, their complete subject matter preparation in marketing or in business finance or in accounting or some other area.
Mm-hmm.
I might just, since we've gotten into this graduate school service I had on the administrative committee, go to this co-op program with the teacher colleges. Now, with the state colleges, they were no longer called teacher colleges, but in the early 1960s, do you have that date anywhere? But I think it was something like 62 that the state colleges, who had been preparing undergraduate teachers and undergraduate program for years and years and years, began to want to develop a graduate program. And there was a committee formed of representatives from each of these state colleges, and Professor Barr of the School of Education, Department of Education, was the chairman. And I served on that committee, and the program was finally established where the student would take 2 years of work at Whitewater or at Stout or at Stevens Point, wherever, and then would transfer. Now, this is all for teacher education in the various disciplines across the board, but there was a set program established for the state colleges to give. And I guess maybe they might have been known as state universities by that time. They were at least going in that direction. And but it was understood that any teacher wishing to enter that program, they'd go to Whitewater, let's say, for the first 2 years, whether it be an elementary education or whether it's business ed or what. They would make application to Whitewater, but Whitewater then would send the application to me, and then I would check with, if it was a science education, I would check with Milton Powell. If it was math, I'd go to the person in math to get a recommendation. And then I would funnel this. I was sort of the administrative person in charge of these admissions and testing and so forth. And I had a secretary provided by the school, by the graduate school at that time, working with me. And our office up on the fourth floor of the education was the location of it. So we would get these from all over the state to come in, and we would send them then to the graduate school with the recommendation that I had been able to secure from the appropriate groups. And then this operated for 2 years. Then the people would move here the third year and pursue their degree in appropriate courses depending upon their discipline, whether math, science, or language, or what. And this program operated for about 4 years, about 5 years, I guess, about the time that we would have begun to have had a good, maybe less than that though. I guess maybe less than that. Maybe they had gone 2 years at the state colleges and then perhaps 2 years beyond. The legislature authorized the state colleges then to assume their own graduate program. And so we had these people that started and finished, and so it went on for some years, but the numbers decreased sharply, of course, when they could continue right on at Whitewater, let's say, and finish the degree there.
Now, this is the sort of thing that, you know, one tells a story by saying, well, it got started about this year, but from your knowledge, where did the impetus for this begin? That is,
I would say the emphasis got started by the state universities, the personnel in school of education and those institutions, appealing to the legislature and through other agencies to establish graduate programs. And I think the university administration and personnel saw that this would be desirable to have an intermediate step of a cooperative program and let the services, let the expertise of the faculty in the School of Education, and this was a School of Education program, be given to these other institutions before they were doing the program completely. So I would say that I can't recall exactly who authorized the committee. There was a committee that was, I don't know, I'm a little vague on this, I guess at this point I cannot clearly point my finger to the agency that established the committee that met for 2 years prior to the establishment of the program. And we met, there's a large group because each of the state universities had, I think, maybe two representatives, and we met here in Madison. Sometimes we'd meet out in the other areas. So this is the short resume of the co-op programs that did exist, and now I am interested to observe at Whitewater, for example, some of the courses and aspects of that co-op program that was established at that time are still in existence. That is, I think the influence that was exerted by the committee, with many people represented from the School of Education on the committee, had its effect in determining what is now the program. I should have backed up. I think we discussed informally the other day when we were chatting about the co-op program when UW-Milwaukee was established. Now that was preceded. That was about 1956 or 7, about 57. When through legislative enactment, the Extension Division program in Milwaukee and the Teachers College over there, Milwaukee State College, were combined as a part of the university system, and that was the only other campus at that time. So for many, many years, for several years, the graduate program offered on both campuses was considered to be from the same graduate school. That is, there was one graduate school that served as a tent for the program both in Milwaukee and here. And I got started going over in business ed and offering graduate courses over there.
at my own pleasure, really. I obviously got permission from the deans, but I took this as part of my assignment, and each year for many years, the second semester, I would offer one of my professional courses in Milwaukee, and I had a large number of graduate students at the master's level working in this program, and I would go and spend the day there, and the class would usually start in the afternoon, 4:30, but until 4:30 I would be meeting individuals who'd come in and needing help. Some were working on their research projects for their thesis in the master's program. And so that carried on for, well, until maybe the early 70s.
Yeah.
And, but may I just add this footnote, while we started out initially as one graduate school, one school of education, covering both campuses, in due time, obviously it developed that this thing of getting the groups together, meeting, we used to meet halfway in Watertown or some other place, you know, and it's so much time and effort, and in due time people felt, well, they should go their way and we should go our way, and they became more and more separate. And but the graduate school continued far longer than the undergraduate program, and it was not until, as I say, in the 70s, sometime early 70s, that the graduate school separated.
I gather that the technical facilities for the sort of telephone or television hookups that they use around the state now were not available to you at that time.
No, they weren't. No, they were not.
Okay. Why don't we sort of switch directions or gears for a second, and I'd like to have you elaborate a little bit about your research activity here. Maybe I can start out by saying or asking the things that you've been well known for are things that you did primarily in the 60s, and yet the university usually expects people to do research from day one, so to speak, because that's part of your tenure track, business and all that. Can you elaborate some on the kinds of research you pursued in your first few years here, and then what led you to get into the other kinds of research that you did later on?
Well, I guess most of my research has been the field research dealing with improvement in methodology and teaching in our area, and really started early with the multi-channel dictation labs, and we were the first in the country to establish this kind of a program. And Alan Lensing was a doctoral student of mine at the time, and she and I worked together very much in establishing the first of these labs, using East High School here in Madison and Washington High School in Racine as the two schools for this experimentation. Now the whole idea, of course, in developing a multi, and we coined a term, and it's still used, a multi-channel lab. But this was developed with the idea that to multiply the dictation speeds in developing, attempting to develop skills in shorthand, for example. You dictate at speeds appropriate for the level of a student. And when you have a range, as you always do in a course like this, from, let's say, 60 words a minute to 100 words a minute, and the teacher only dictates one speed, some of the students are not being challenged, others are being frustrated by the fact it may be too rapid. So we evolved the idea of a multiplicity of dictation speeds through recorded dictation and having some sort of panel of X number of playback units, and we use four, and this became standard, really. I suppose if we started out with five, that would have become standard, but it seemed to us, and this was merely from our judgment, from having many years of experience working with classes as to the range of ability, that four probably would be sufficient. So we set up the labs with four
four dictation units that would be wired to each of the desks, and the student could switch from one, two, three, or four. So if the program and channel one would be appropriate for that student, that student would be able to move to that.
Can I ask a question? Yeah. I gather that at least through the 40s and 50s, that this sort of instruction that this tool was supposed to facilitate was usually done orally by the teacher.
Right.
Rather than by any machine.
That's right, because when you do orally, of course, as I mentioned before, you can only obviously dictate one speed at a time. Now, there's still a great deal that is done orally. You don't ever replace that. But to provide the to multiplicity of speed through the recording, it does permit the teacher then the opportunity to observe students as they're working, to counsel students with respect to the appropriate speed that they might be taking. And so we not only developed the equipment, we also developed the programs. And and this was by recording. And Alan Lindsay and I spent many, many hours recording materials at for 30-minute tapes that made it possible for what we do in shorthand live, we try to put on the tape. And by having a small segment of material, usually, let's say it's a 5-minute length dictation, so you take 1 minute and dictate it at three speeds. And there are preview sheets with the correct shorthand outlines that the student would have to check. So you take it once and then check, then you take a second time and check, and the third time. Then you take another segment and dictate it in three different times and check the shorthand outlines from the preview material, and so forth through the 5 minutes of the dictation that we standardized. At that time, it was generally considered if you could take dictation for 80 words a minute for 5 minutes, you could establish yourself at that level. And so we made a large number of these tapes so that the East High School in Madison and Washington High School, and we, so that they could have sufficient tapes for each of their four channels, they could be a different program. And so that developed, and Ellen used the results of the study for her PhD dissertation. There was obviously evident from the study that this procedure was beneficial in developing skill, because it provided for this take care of individual differences.
Mm. Now let me ask a question to see if I can set this into a somewhat broader context. If I understand correctly, languages are also now often taught in the same manner. At the time that you did your research, were languages already being taught in this manner?
Well, there were language labs. There were language labs that were coming on at the time, and I think that was a part of the background that we needed to be able to utilize that concept. Now, their utilization is entirely different than obviously in shorthand, but to the concept idea of individualizing the learning through a lab, language lab, basically the same as in what we had in business. That is, out here the student could switch from one to another, and he could record in the language he records, and it's what he and it's played back, and he has earphones, he or she, whoever it may be.
Now, yeah, see, it's sort of a question of technology, I guess.
Yeah.
That's the main thing. When you ran your program and did your tests on and stuff, then how was this sort of put out into the field, so to speak, for general use, that is, in a sense, commercialized?
Well, we did not get involved. Incidentally, if I had resigned my position at the university, and if Ellen and I had established a
commercial house, we, I think, could have become millionaires, because it was just at a time when federal funds were becoming available from to schools to buy special equipment, unique equipment and programs. And so we had, we did not get involved at all, but we but there were several commercial outfits that instantly saw the opportunities here, and within a period of a few years they began. Now the one initially that we had at East and one at Washington was custom made to our design and by electronics people that we were able to secure, and they and I originally developed the design, and it's published in one of our journals, just how to do it. But now there's much more sophisticated programs. Instead of having wire programs, they're wireless, and the student has a little radio reception, you know. And so it's become the basic idea is still retained, but it's a different kind of equipment.
Do you think that this sort of equipment that is needed for this kind of program would generally be available in these schools without the aid of the federal government? That is, do you think that there would be enough impetus for them to get it, or are they ever aided in these efforts by local businesses or whatnot in establishing this equipment?
Well, initially, there were many schools that established the program from the publishing that we did and describing how the equipment is to be established from local funds as a part of the regular budget. But now with federal funds being available, many school systems are seeing this as an opportunity to move from what was formerly purchased from local funds to the federal funds, and that relieves the burden somewhat there. So I think many of these are purchased. Unfortunately, I think there's been a tremendous waste of taxpayers' money, not only in business ed, but in many areas where some company has sold the idea of this equipment, and it's purchased. It's a good idea, but teachers are not qualified. They are not so inclined to use it, and it's my impression, and I've seen some good examples of that caused me to make this conclusion. A lot of this is equipment being stored on shelves and not being used, but there's no doubt in my mind that much more has been purchased because federal funds are available, to answer your question.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was begun about 1960, I believe.
Yes, right. 59-60 is our first year of experimenting with it.
Now, from what I've come across, that's the earliest research outside of book writing that I'm aware that you've done. Is there other, are there other things that you did in your first years, you know, in the late 40s and 50s, in terms of, well,
no,
what
I can't.
Term
you can't. Other than you see, as you know, you have taught, and so you appreciate the fact that I had graduate students, and I was working with them constantly on research. We had, and throughout my 30 years, all graduate students had to complete a research project of some kind to meet the requirements for the degree. And so I was involved with my graduate students in all kinds of field research. Research dealing with, for example, assessing within the community the job opportunities, or assessing the kinds of equipment, or assessing what was important for students to know to fulfill the job requirements, to find out surveys of students as they graduated from high school or from the technical institutes as to what kind of jobs they took, how well they're doing. So
from the very beginning, I have been involved throughout my 30 years in a great deal that kind of research, and frankly, I think that's the kind of research that's most appropriate, significant for a person in business education to be working with the business community. And I did a great deal. I belonged to the National Office Management Association. I was on the committee. That's an organization that worked closely with business educators in inviting teachers in, because they were the National Office Management. It's been name has been changed to the National Office not Management Business, it escapes me, but the name has been changed in recent years, but it remains the same, that the administrators who employ the product of the high schools and technical schools preparing business teachers are the ones that belong to this institution. And I, this organization, and I served on their committees for throughout my 30 years, at Milwaukee chapter as well as the Madison chapter.
Now, a follow-up to that, this is sort of a matter of philosophy, and when you receive students, graduate students, and they sought to do the research, did they usually come to you and say, well, I kind of like to do this, or was it a matter of the two of you sitting down and trying to figure out something, or did you have a program of research that you thought was needed, or one step further, as you mentioned, your ties with the business community and communities around the state, did you often receive ideas of information that people out in the state wanted to find out about, this Wisconsin idea of business,
yeah.
And then you decided that maybe you'd have a student do research in this area, is this community service kind of thing?
Well, yeah, I think combination of all of those, really. I had a seminar, and the purpose of the seminar was to explore various research possibilities that students might be interested to pursue, might be appropriate for them to do. And so instead of the first few years, I didn't have the seminar, and it was done entirely through one-to-one relationship, but that's very time-consuming. You do it all that way. And so when we, after a few years, developed the seminar that these ideas were explored. We studied what others had done. We studied the research procedures and how to go about collecting the data and so forth. I was not a research specialist as a person might today be found in teaching research methods in mm-hmm. ed psychology, for example. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, it did serve to acquaint the graduate student with the various possibilities. And they would review, as I say, what others had done. We got ideas from all sources. For example, there were several studies that were done with various aspects of the multi-channel to carry on the program. And then later on, when we got into program shorthand, there were several studies that evolved from that. Part of my research that I might say that I was very much involved in did have some outshoots carried on by certain of our graduate students.
If in the 60s you could typify your research in sort of the technical end of things, or in organizing the classroom and with new technology, do you think it would be possible to typify the general direction of your research, say, in the early 50s or late 40s in some way like that? What most of your research
is directed at? I would say that most of the research, and I have to say the research that was actually carried on by the people. If you were to go through the titles of the students who completed their master's degree, for example, there's a brochure that was compiled at the time I retired, and there's some 300 or 400 studies are listed in there. But in that period, it would be, I would think, more dealing with surveys of the community, surveys of what students have done who graduated from high school. I would say that it was more one of collecting data in the community that the school was serving, rather than doing working with broadly with methodology such as we did with multi-channel or with the program shorthand.
Speaking of the programmed shorthand, can you discuss that a little bit? I have these names, but I'm not sure how they
Yeah, well, let me just say that I had been in the early 50s invited, 1950 to be exact, to join a team to develop the college shorthand program. Up until that time, strange as it may seem, Greg Shorthand had only one edition that was used at all levels, the material, so that whether you're in high school or college, you use the same book. So beginning in 49, the work started. A separate series was developed to accommodate the college population, and I was invited to join the team that had been authoring the shorthand at the high school level.
You were invited by who?
By the Greg Publishing Company. It wasn't something that I developed and sold to them. They came to me and felt that I was a person, Robert Slaughter, who was manager of the Greg division, had been here. We started summer 1947, an annual summer institute, and we brought in people at that time. You know, there was only one in the state, so we were, it was a really a big affair. We'd have several hundred teachers here, and Bob Slaughter came summer 48, 47, 48, 49. That, we got acquainted through that contact, and he became manager of the Greg division, and when he became manager of the Greg division, he felt we should have a college program, and he invited me to be to join the team, which I did starting then in 1950, and have been a co-author to all their shorthand programs at the college level, and there have been four different editions that I've been party to, and of course it's terminated that. I'm on terminal contract now. The next time around, there'll be others. But long, the program idea of learning was developing in the early 60s, as you know, very extensively. And Greg got the idea that there ought to be a program shorthand developed. And they invited four of us. Arnold Condon was one, Robert Grubbs was another, Harry Huffman was the third one, and I was the fourth, and I was the coordinator and senior author of it. But we did a great deal of experimenting and developing the materials. We experimented by developing materials and getting students to try it out, and we had observers, and we carried on our experimentation for many years before it was actually published in a bound, before that was duplicated through a offset process. And but all four. Now, Harry Huffman had done a great deal of work in program learning and in other areas in the field of math, for example.
Where was he at?
Well, he was at Virginia Technical. What is it, Virginia? Technical
Polytechnic
School of Virginia, and Harry and Grubbs was University of Pittsburgh, and Arnold Condon was at in Illinois, University of Illinois. Now, prior to this, I had authored as the first author a transcription book, and see, I had been on the Volume 1, Volume 2, and then the transcription book had been with the first two. I was with another team, and so I was third on the list. But with the transcription book, I was the first, and on that was the Grubbs and the fellow by the name of Wagner, George Wagner, from the University of Tennessee. And we authored the transcription book that was to follow the two, volumes 1 and volume 2, at the college level. And then I had this opportunity to work with the experimentation with the program materials. And the team that was invited, and I guess I was consulted in advance and decided that these were the people, for various reasons. Arnold Condon had done a great deal of experimenting with various shorthand systems, well informed. As I mentioned, Harry Huffman had already done some work in mathematics and in program work, and Grubbs was just a good practitioner, I guess you would say, from the University of Pittsburgh. Well, that's the way the program shorthand evolved, those two areas, as you mentioned earlier, were probably the thing that I became best known for in the field.
Did Gregg Publishing Company provide financial support for your research then?
Right. Yes, they provided this so that it was sufficient at least to carry the expenses. It wasn't to pay salaries, but we were able to employ some. Now Mary Margaret O'Connell was at that time doing graduate work, and she became very instrumental and was employed as a research assistant to work with us. And she did a tremendous job in collecting all the materials that they were sent in from the various individuals cooperating in the program.
Is this sort of thing still made use of now, the program shorthand material?
Yes, it's still being used, right? And it serves a very fine purpose in where individualized instruction is appropriate. Many schools where they have very small classes will use the program instruction because from our many, many experimental experiences, one can learn the theory of great shorthand very effectively, and you move at your own, see the philosophy, of course, of the program, that you move at your own speed. The difficulty has been the failure of program instruction in all areas, that it hasn't always been monitored properly, and people moving at their own speed sometimes isn't very fast. They goof off, and if a person isn't highly motivated, but if it's properly monitored and proper motivation, program learning can be a very effective tool in learning, I think, many areas, and certainly shorthand theory is one.